Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Lung cancer remains the most deadly form of cancer in the United States. Because it's hard to detect in early stages and historically hard to treat, it claims about 150,000 lives a year. But recently, through a DNA-level study of cancer subtypes, researchers are finding more targeted and more effective approaches to treatment. Here to tell us about the approach at the James Comprehensive Care Center is Dr. Greg Otterson. He's co-director of the Thoracic Oncology Program at the James Cancer Hospital. Welcome to the show.
Thanks much, Ann.
First, why is lung cancer hard to detect in its early stages?
I think there's a couple of reasons. One is that we have never had a screening program until recently, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But then the second thing is that oftentimes patients who get lung cancer are those who have been smokers, and often they have other comorbidities such as coronary artery disease or COPD, which they wake up and expect to have a cough, the smoker's cough, for example, and sometimes the symptoms may mimic just what they've been living with for sometimes years.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, though, I think, is the fact that we never have had an effective screening program. That's changing now. And so back in the 1970s, there were attempts by the National Cancer Institute, as well as other institutions in other countries, to look at chest X-ray screening, and it turned out to be not very effective. So in the early 90s, there was actually a large program established by the National Cancer Institute called the PLCO for prostate, lung, colorectal, and ovarian. And that study was enrolled, I think, 150,000 patients or subjects at risk, didn't have cancer, any of those four cancers, but they were going to be screened. And that was using a chest X-ray and was large enough and, quotes, powered enough from a statistical standpoint to detect a difference. Ended up not detecting a difference, actually. That data just got, at least in lung cancer, just got published relatively recently. But then about 10 years into this study, in about 2001, 2002, the NCI, there was data coming out from multiple institutions that suggested that CT scans might be effective. So in 2002, they launched a sub-study of the PLCO called the NLST for National Lung Screening Study, and in which 50,000 patients at risk of getting lung cancer, so smokers or ex-smokers between the ages of 55 and 74, and they randomized them to annual CT scan of the chest versus annual chest X-ray. And what they found, published I think 2 or 3 years ago now, was that the CT scan, by getting the screening CT scan, low-dose CT scan, you decrease the risk of dying from lung cancer in that group by 20%.
Because you can identify it
Absolutely.
Sooner. Is it that hard to see?
Yes. So chest X-ray turned out to be ineffective.
Yeah, you just can't see it well enough.
But you can see big tumors, but of course when they're big, they're too late.
Right.
The other thing that happens is there's a big lungs, you know, so there's a lot of volume in there, and you can hide a lot in within that. In order to detect a small tumor, which is in theory the most curable, mm-hmm. You really need a technique or a technology like CT scan. So actually the James just about a year and a half ago started offering low-dose CT scans for just those patients. So patients at risk for getting lung cancer, smokers or ex-smokers between the ages of 55 and 74. And one of my colleagues, who's a pulmonologist, Pat Nanasinghe, is running that program. And it's been so far very, very well received.
Is it still experimental, or does insurance pay for it? Or
Insurance is, I think, starting to get the message.
Okay.
I don't think it's experimental, and we're not necessarily billing insurance. I think it's a $99 fee or whatever.
Okay.
However, just in the last year, within the last 6 months, actually, the U.S. Preventive Health Task Force, I forget the, they have
they have another acronym that we won't,
that I can't figure out, but they just gave a good recommendation, basically. So I think based on that recommendation, based on the data, which, by the way, 20% reduction in death doesn't sound like much. It's about the same risk reduction that you see with mammography. So it's, and there's been subsequent studies or subsequent analyses of the data that suggest that it's also cost effective. Mm-hmm. Importantly, one of the things that's really critical with any screening lung cancer screening program is incorporating a risk reduction strategy of smoking cessation. So for those people who are still smoking, do the CT scan screening, but you ought to stop smoking and sort of getting them hooked in with smoking cessation efforts. My guess and our hope, our dearest hope, is that perhaps by next year, that will insurance companies will start to get the message and start to cover CT scans. We certainly think they're appropriate.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday. We're talking about lung cancer screenings and treatment that it could be based in genetics. My guest is Dr. Greg Otterson. He's co-director of the Thoracic Oncology Program at the James. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. So when you approach testing through genetics, what do you achieve by that, both from the screening part of it and then also the treatment part of it? There's two pieces to that.
So for screening, for screening, I don't, we don't have enough information yet, to be honest with you.
Okay.
So, let me clarify as well that when we talk about genetics, it's not talking about inherited genetics. So mm-hmm. We're not talking about the lung cancer gene analogous to the breast cancer BRCA1 or BRCA2. This is what we would call the other side of genetics, called somatic genetics. So in other words, this is mutations that develop within the cancer and we think drive the cancer. So sort of initiate the cancer in its very early stages when it's one or two cells and then cause it to develop a larger tumor and then ultimately metastasize and such. So it's those somatic genetics that we're testing, not the inherited genetics. So we, at this point, have no sort of identified lung cancer susceptibility gene.
So somebody who has lung cancer, it's not necessarily helpful to check to see if their kids have something inherited.
Right. Okay. Now, data are still coming out.
Sure.
And clearly
everything's
there are,
always changing.
Right. And clearly there are family susceptibilities. We just aren't smart enough yet to figure out what those are. And it's probably pretty complicated. It's a lot more complicated. It's likely a lot more complicated than a single, you know, monogenic trait. It might be that there's multiple genes that affect your susceptibility, whether it's related to smoking, you know, smoke carcinogen susceptibility or other things like that.
How many kinds of lung cancers are there?
I think that's a great question to lead into to talking about this genomics. So ask that 10 years ago, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, and most oncologists would say there's two kinds of lung cancer. We call them small cell lung cancer and non-small cell lung cancer. And small cell lung cancer was treated in one particular way, represents about 15% of all lung cancers diagnosed, highly smoking associated, typically never treated with surgery or rarely treated with surgery, typically with chemo and radiation. And then non-small cell lung cancer depends upon stage, we would treat with surgery or chemo radiation or chemotherapy alone. The sort of revolution that's happened in the last 10 years since about 2004, at least in clinical circles, is the recognition that that non-small cell pie, which if you do the math, that represents about 85% of all lung cancers or around almost 200,000 patients per year, is actually much more complicated. So on the very first pass, we recognize that there's a difference in terms of just looking under the microscope. There's called squamous cancers and adenocarcinomas, and that's actually been recognized for many years. But up until about 5 or 10 years ago, we didn't treat them differently. They were all lumped together as one non-small cell lung cancer. Then more recently, we've done these genetic testings, and recognized that within this large category of adenocarcinoma, which is the most common type of lung cancer, there's different subtypes that respond very differently. So we now talk about KRAS mutant lung cancers as opposed to EGFR mutant lung cancers or ALK mutant lung cancers.
And that all matters.
And that all matters in terms of choice of treatment
and
prognosis as well as predictive.
So when we talk about choice of treatment, have the choices of treatment changed along with this?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and really, I think the watershed moment, if you will, happened in 2004 So at that time, maybe 4 to 5 years earlier than that, there was the development of some novel drugs called gefitinib and erlotinib. And those are inhibitors of a gene called EGFR. And let me step back a little bit. The way I describe it, we're an automobile country, so I describe it sort of in terms of the gas pedal and the brake. So cancer cells have genes and proteins that cause them to grow and accelerate and proliferate, and they also have brakes. And typically, cancer is a mismanagement of the gas pedals and the brakes. The gas pedals, and there's usually more than one, are always on, and the brakes or the tumor suppressor genes are always off. So in this case, EGFR, stands for epidermal growth factor receptor, is turned on. And so in the late 90s, they developed these molecules of pills, gefitinib and erlotinib, that could be taken to inhibit the activity of that gas pedal of EGFR. And it was some interesting observations. It was first made in Boston, people at Dana-Farber and Mass General, but other places in New York and in Vanderbilt, where they recognized that while most patients had sort of a okay response, sort of stabilization of disease, maybe for 8 or 12 weeks, not a long time, every once in a while, maybe 10% of the time, when you would give a patient this drug, they would have an amazing response. And in fact, we then termed it the Lazarus response. Huh. So typically where patients might come in a wheelchair, they're on high flow oxygen, they can't walk around, they can't take care of themselves, they would take this pill and a week or two later, they'd call up their doc and say, hey, you know, I don't need this oxygen anymore and I'm out playing with my grandkids.
But they didn't know why.
Right. So what it took was this. So these phenomenal responses, relatively uncommon, maybe 10% of patients. What it took was to recognize that something special there. Uh-huh. And so they got the tumor from those patients and they analyzed them. And what they found, and initially this was published in May of 2004, they found that there were mutations within this gene, epidermal growth factor receptor, that made the gene always turned on, but at the same time made them exquisitely sensitive to very low levels of this drug, erlotinib or gefitinib. And so this sort of concept of oncogene addiction, or these tumors being really driven by specifically by this gene and being very sensitive to inhibition of that gene. And a couple things then came out over the next couple years that happened to be more common in adenocarcinomas. Tends to be, for reasons still not entirely clear, more common in people of Asian ethnicity, so East Asian, so Chinese, Japanese, Korean particularly, and also tends to be very heavily overrepresented in non-smokers or never smokers. So mm-hmm. smokers don't have a zero chance of having this, but a lower chance of having these mutations. The relevance, though, and this was then sort of actually, I'd say, proven over the last 9 years, is that in those patients that have this gene mutation, their first treatment ought to be not chemotherapy, but a pill that is taken every day, often is very well tolerated, does have some side effects. It's not free. It has, you know, some rash and diarrhea that sometimes can be associated with it, but can control the make the disease shrink dramatically, cause sometimes this Lazarus effect, and have patients be stable on the treatment for sometimes years. I just saw a lady on Monday that's been on treatment with erlotinib since 2006 with metastatic lung cancer.
Which was a death sentence back
sure,
in the day.
Sure. She's not cured, and she recognizes uh-huh. that. But
she's alive.
She's doing phenomenally well. We were talking on Monday about her desire to go to Florida again. So over the last 7 years, she's gone to Florida pretty much every winter, goes to Fort Myers. And
let me ask you this from the start of our conversation about the screenings. Is there someplace people can go to find out whether they would qualify or whether they're a candidate for a screening?
Sure. I think the best best number, I'm sure, and I apologize, I should know the line directly to our screening, but the best line is to call the James line.
Okay.
And it's 293-4444 and ask about lung cancer screening. They should be able to refer on to the proper thing. And Dr. Patrick Nanasinkum is the guy that runs that.
Okay. All right. So if you're wondering whether you fit the bill, we'll post that number on our website at wosu.org/allsides. we could talk longer, but we're out of time right now. I want to thank you for joining us. So this has been very interesting.
Great. It's a pleasure to be here. And I could talk longer, as you can sort of tell, I guess.
Dr. Greg Otterson. Well, it's good news. So it's nice to talk about good news when it comes to something like lung cancer. Dr. Greg Otterson, he's co-director of the Thoracic Oncology Program at the James Cancer Hospital. And once again, if you want to know whether you're a candidate for one of those lung cancer screenings, you can go to the phone number that he gave us. We'll post that at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we will continue with Wellness Wednesday. We're going to return to our series on the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. We're going to go with factcheck.org and debunk some myths out there on both sides of the game. So come back with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher and our continuing segment devoted to the ins and outs of the Affordable Care Act, also known affectionately by some as Obamacare. The U.S. Senate is expected to take a key vote today that would pave the way for a showdown over Obamacare. Meanwhile, you've probably been seeing some political-style ads on the topic of Obamacare that might be confusing. Pro-Obamacare groups are trying to convince the public of that program's physical and financial benefits. Opposition groups warn of government takeovers and limits on freedom. One recent ad depicted a menacing Uncle Sam-type figure about to perform a pelvic exam in a doctor's office. With the healthcare exchanges set to open October 1, it's time to cut through the hyperbole. Joining us now for some myth-busting is Lori Robertson. She's managing editor of factcheck.org. That's a nonpartisan, nonprofit project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. She joins us by phone from Washington. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's just get to the one issue that doesn't really have anything to do with anyone's health per se, and that's that it's a job killer. We hear that 8.2 million part-time workers can't find full-time work in part because of the law. What do we know about its effect on job availability now or going into the future?
Sure. Well, let's start with that 8.2 million Americans can't find full-time work partly due to Obamacare. That claim is false. It comes from the Republican National Committee, and their 8.2 million figure was actually the total number in June of part-time workers in the U.S. who are seeking full-time work. This is a category that the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls part-time for economic reasons. Now, certainly somebody in there, or we don't know how many people of that 8.2 million may have had their hours cut from their employer and they're now part-time seeking full-time work. And maybe they have done it because of the healthcare law, but we don't know how many that may be, and neither does the Republican National Committee. What we did do was look at those Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers to see if there was any evidence that the law has had an impact on this category of part-time workers, and we did not find any evidence that there's been an impact. There were more of these part-time for economic reasons folks in March 2010 when the Affordable Care Act was signed, and the figure has been fluctuating in recent years but has been trending downward. So, you know, we're just not seeing a big impact from the law. This category of workers really exploded in 2008 when we were in a time of economic recession. And I can keep going. Maybe you want to ask another question. Well, I can talk about the claim in general about it being a job killer.
Yeah. I mean, the claim in general about being a job killer, is that only related to the issue of companies or businesses offering health insurance, or is there another aspect to it?
Well, it is related to that. You know, we've seen those words job killer all the time about the law. And what we've said is that it's overblown. right now, there's only a couple of economic analyses, nonpartisan economic analyses, that we can look at for an estimate of what impact the law is going to have on jobs. And they've both estimated a small loss of mainly low-wage jobs because of the law. Now, there are a couple reasons for that. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said that we would mainly see a decrease in the amount of labor that workers choose to supply. And they said that because a lot of people are going to get subsidies to help them buy insurance, and it's essentially like more money in your pocket. So folks who may have been working an extra job or extra hours to try to afford insurance or pay their medical bills may cut back on working. But then beyond that, the Congressional Budget Office said that there would be a small impact on low-wage jobs, and you know, that is because of the employer requirements. Employers have to, with 50 or more employees, have to provide insurance or pay a fine. And you know, as a lot of workers probably know, employers tend to pass costs on to their workers. So if you're giving and employers consider your health insurance part of your compensation. So if you're getting health insurance, you know, your wage may be lower. But if you are at minimum wage or low wage, an employer can only reduce your wages so much, right, before they'll have to do something like hire fewer people. Now, there's a lot of things that then could happen because of that. If some employers are hiring fewer low-wage workers, the Congressional Budget Office says they may then hire more part-time or seasonal workers, basically because somebody has to do the work. But at any rate, overall, we've seen from that Congressional Budget Office analysis and also another one by a group called the Lewin Group that they've just said there would be a small impact on jobs.
Another myth. The big brother healthcare. Is it a myth, or is there going to be more government involvement in hopefully short of Uncle Sam and the, you know, doing public exams? But is there some truth to that or not?
Well, no, there's not any kind of what we've seen those claims say is that the law is setting up a government-run system, government-run healthcare, like you would find in many other countries, Canada, for instance, or England, where there's universal health coverage. And it doesn't do that. It actually expands private insurance by a lot, by about 12 million new customers for private insurers. Again, that's according to the Congressional Budget Office estimates. Now, the law will expand Medicaid as well, and that's a government-run program. Both Medicaid and Medicare. And also there are a lot of restrictions put on insurance companies that are selling insurance on these exchanges or selling insurance to folks who buy their own coverage on the individual market. So they won't be able to discriminate based on pre-existing conditions. They basically have to take all comers, everybody who applies for insurance. They can't charge more based on health status. They can't put caps on your coverage or limits on your coverage and various regulations on the insurance company. But we've said that's really more of a case of the government coming between you and your insurance company, not the government coming between you and your doctor.
Are premiums going up or down because of Obamacare? And how do we distinguish those changes from whatever changes would have occurred anyway without Obamacare? My premiums have been increasing every year since I started getting employer-provided health insurance 25 years ago. So how do we distinguish what has been an annual increase for most of us anyway from whatever happens, whichever way they jog after Obamacare goes into effect?
Well, you know, I think it's going to be pretty much impossible for, you know, the average person to make that distinction. And you're right. I mean, premiums have been going up for decades and they'll continue to go up. You know, when Democrats and the White House, when they say that premiums are going to go down, what they really mean is that they'll go down compared with what they may have been otherwise or what they would have been otherwise, or the rate of growth will go down is what they really mean, because premiums are not going to flat out go down. They're going to continue to rise. And we, you know, the only way to really tease out the impact of the law is to turn to economists and you know, kind of wait for someone to do some of these economic analyses where they, you know, run the data through a model and we get some indication of what percentage of the increase was due to the law, what percentage of the increase was due to something else. And, you know, the overall question, you know, are my premiums going to go up or my premiums going to go down? You know, we've said it really depends. For most folks with employer-sponsored insurance, there really won't be much of a change. You know, most employer-sponsored insurance meets the requirements of the law, the insurance regulations of the law already. And where we'll see some differences are on those individual markets and those exchange plans, people who are buying their own insurance. And, you know, for some folks, they may see a decrease, particularly if they had a health condition, for instance, a pre-existing condition, maybe they couldn't get insurance, or maybe the premiums that were quoted to them were really high because insurers could charge more based on your health condition. Mm-hmm. Well, they're not going to be able to do that. So, you know, someone in that circumstance may see a decrease, an actual, you know, decrease, not just a lower rate of growth. But then you may have some younger folks or healthy folks who were able to get very cheap plans, and maybe they didn't feel that they needed a lot of coverage, and now the law is requiring plans to cover a certain level of benefits, and that will certainly increase premiums. And then the change in the way these policies are priced, not based on health status, could mean a higher premium for healthier folks.
But factoring in whether or not you fall into the range of subsidization that sort of, or Medicaid even, if it, of course, in Ohio, we aren't going to have the Medicaid expansions as it stands, so that wouldn't be mm-hmm. an issue. But who's checking income claims on the exchange applications? A lot of people think that you can just lie and then mm-hmm. get more subsidy.
Yeah. Well, when you submit these applications for subsidies, and yeah, when I was talking just now about premiums, that wasn't factoring in the subsidies. So that would be a whole separate
right.
thing. If you qualified for the subsidies, then yeah, your out-of-pocket cost may be substantially lower. But back to, you know, who's checking. Well, you'll submit this application for an exchange plan and for subsidies, and your income that you list will be checked against available federal information, such as previous tax returns. If you didn't file a previous tax return, you'll be asked for some more information. But at some point, these exchanges are going to get some applications that are suspect, that they just don't have government data, current income information isn't available, and you know, they need to face additional scrutiny. Well, initially, all of those suspect applications would face this additional scrutiny, but the administration gave the exchanges some leeway this year. They came out and said that for this first year of operation, the exchanges would only have to further scrutinize a sample of those applications. Now, that's not to say... you know, I suppose you could lie and maybe you'll slip through the cracks. But once you file your 2014 tax return, your income claim on that subsidy application will be checked against your 2014 tax return. And at that point, the IRS can recoup at least some of the money that you, if you receive money you shouldn't have. And then beyond that, of course, there are IRS perjury penalties. There's also some penalties that are spelled out, monetary penalties spelled out in the Affordable Care Act if you provide fraudulent information.
The question of whether you can pick your own doctor. Once again, I pay a premium if I go, an extra premium, if I go outside my network. That's always been that mm-hmm. way. Is that what they're talking about or something more sinister?
Well, you know, it's
I already can't pick my own doctor.
Yeah, well, you can from a list, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's not going to change. I mean, that's what it's going to continue to be for really, no matter where you get your insurance from an employer, if you buy it on your own, you know, there are networks of providers and I don't know, maybe some folks have a very generous insurance plan that includes pretty much everybody. But, you know, yeah, for most of us, we've got a list of providers mm-hmm. that are in network that we would choose from. So that's not going to change. The one concern, however, and there have been a couple of news stories about this recently, is that some of these plans that will be offered on the exchanges, insurers are creating some fairly narrow networks of insurance providers. So still a choice, still a network, but they're creating a narrower network, and they're doing that in order to keep the premiums lower. So they say they can sign up certain providers to be part of their network, and if it's a smaller network, they can charge less for premiums. They can make the coverage more affordable. So it remains to be seen, you know, how widespread that would be on the exchanges, and, you know, I guess it's an individual preference or, you know, opinion on how you would feel about that. But that would be for, again, for people buying these plans on the exchanges.
The president has claimed that if you like your plan, you can keep your plan, and the same goes for your doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's really related. And we've said that that's misleading. And we've been saying that, you know, ever since President Obama has been making this claim. And for some of the reasons I just discussed, also, the law just doesn't guarantee that you can keep your plan. It doesn't guarantee that your employer won't switch plans just as they could do before the law.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you switch jobs, your new work-based coverage might not have your doctor as an in-network provider. So that was true before the law, and it's true now. He just can't make this promise to everyone.
And then finally, Congress. Is Congress exempt? And what does it mean? I mean, they are already getting health care coverage, right? So what's the issue with Congress?
Mm-hmm. We've seen this claim again and again over the years that Congress is somehow exempt from the law, and it's just not true. No matter how many different ways we've seen this thing spun, you know, this all relates to what is actually an additional requirement for Congress in the law. Beginning next year, 2014, Congress and their staffs are no longer able to get their insurance the way they normally have. They can't get the federal health benefits, the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program that other employees get. And instead, under the law, they'll be required to get their insurance through the exchanges. So some of these exempt claims first percolated when that provision was being added to the law. Now, recently, there was concern on Capitol Hill, you know, what does this mean for the employer contribution that the federal government makes to its employees' health plans, just as, you know, any employer, or most employers, I should say, make toward their workers' health plans. The law didn't really spell out how the government was going to still be able to make that contribution with Congress and staffers getting plans on the exchanges. So in August, the Office of Personnel Management, which oversees the Federal Health Benefits Program, issued a rule saying that government can continue to make these contributions. It would be the same level of contribution that the government makes under the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, but they could make those premium contributions to the exchange plans that Congress and their staffers get. So that prompted these new claims that Congress was somehow getting special treatment. We've seen claims saying that Congress was getting a special subsidy that other Americans couldn't get, and that they were somehow exempt from the law. Well, you know, it's just not true. What that ruling did was continue the status quo. The federal government will be able to continue to contribute toward its workers' premiums, just as it was before.
All right. Well, Lori Robertson, there may be more myths afoot. We don't have time for them right now, but in the future, more myths to bust. Thanks for joining us today to do it.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me.
Lori Robertson, she's the managing editor at factcheck.org. Coming up, we're going to talk about falling. You take it for granted, we're all going to fall sometime, but falling can be a serious problem, particularly for older people. We're going to talk about a plan at the state level to address that. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. To fall or not to fall? We can't stop the season, but the Ohio Department of Aging is working on how to stop its constituents from falling. And for good reason, nearly one-third of adults 65 and older fall each year. Every 2 minutes, an older Ohioan is falling, and every 5 minutes, he or she is injured in that fall. That means emergency rooms and hospitalizations and sometimes death. In fact, falls by older adults are related to 3 deaths each day in Ohio. Joining us to talk about that is Bonnie Berman. She's director of the Ohio Department of Aging, which kicked off its Steady Youp Ohio program last week. Welcome to the show, Bonnie.
Thank you, Ann.
Also with us is Renee Owens. She's a physical therapist at the Wexner Medical Center, where they want to start screening for falls among patients. And you can tell us about that as well. Renee, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you.
Bonnie Berman, I read on your website that falls and fall-related injuries cost Ohio more than $4.2 billion every year. Why does it cost the state money?
It costs the state money because of all of the care that is provided to individuals after they fall.
So the idea to prevent it so you're not spending the money in the end.
Our intent with all of this is to prevent falls, not primarily to save money, but because we care about every citizen. And our elders are so vital to us, and we want to ensure that they have a wonderful life.
I also read that falls are not a normal part of aging, and most falls can be prevented. If they aren't a normal part of aging, why do they occur more frequently in that age group, and why are you addressing it then?
Isn't it so funny, Anne, that everyone just makes the assumption that to get old is that you're going to fall and that it's inevitable? And so with our Steady You Ohio initiative, those are actually the key things that we're trying to help people understand. It's not a normal part of aging, and you can do something to prevent it. And the reason that older adults may have more falls than anyone else is for a couple of reasons, because the most common risk factors first are a fear of falling. Mm. So if people think they're going to fall, they just might fall. So we're trying to eliminate that risk. Secondly, folks fall because of inactivity. And that if you're not getting out, you're not in good shape, you don't have sufficient exercise, and you don't have the balance because of that, you might fall more. So we know we can prevent that too. Third, changes in eyesight and some of our hearing issues, believe it or not, have an impact. The use of multiple medications. Hmm. They may interact with each other and cause some problems. Sometimes poor nutrition. But interestingly enough, it's also, after you do all of that, it's hazards, both in the home and out in public.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And it is fall. It's a season of fall, but it's also 24/7, 365 days a year, the season of falling. My guests are Bonnie Berman. She's director of the Ohio Department of Aging, where they have started a new program to address that issue in the state of Ohio. It is called Steady You Ohio. We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Also with us is Renee Owens. She's a physical therapist at Wexner Medical Center. Renee, at Wexner Medical Center, you are talking about and working on screening people who have fallen before, or screening people who might be at danger of falling? Can you tell us about what you're working on?
It could be a little bit of, it could be both.
Okay.
Currently, we see patients in our program. We have patients that are in the acute care, in the Dodd Hall facility, and then in our outpatient rehab, which we screen them and assess them for falls each time we get referrals and we're treating those patients. What we would like to do in the outpatient rehab side is develop a screening and assessment to get out into the community to address whether it's assisted living facilities, people that maybe they are concerned with their family members that might be getting older and are they have a fear of falling there, or they feel that they're at a risk from falling. People that live in independent living facilities or even senior centers may want to, for those people, for us to come out and do a screening assessment on them and then look at what their risk factor is for falls. Maybe they, we would talk with their primary care physician, get a referral for therapy, have them come in and personalize that health care to them for their fall risk. Maybe it's an exercise program. Maybe they need a further referral on to another provider in order to look at them further as to the causes of falling and why they are falling.
You know, Bonnie Berman, it was interesting when you said one of the causes of falling is a fear of falling, because I was just talking to somebody this morning whose mother-in-law actually went to a falling class where they learned to fall so mm-hmm. that it would address the fear of falling, mm-hmm. I suppose, also learning how to fall safely.
Right. It's so interesting that once you have that fear, everything becomes a falls
I'm
risk.
I'm afraid of falling. Now, more than I was when I was a lot younger.
I can tell you that I just turned 60, and over the summer I was in a boating accident and I fell. And when I was in the hospital down in North Carolina, I got this beautiful yellow band that identified me as a falls risk. And as soon as I had that on, I got afraid of getting out of bed. And the only way they were ever, I'm the poster child now for this, the only way they got me out of bed was to convince me to use a walker. And once I did that, I established my sense of internal balance and that I was going to be okay. But I'm living what it's like, just like you're saying, of fear of falling. And so what we are trying to do at the state, and we're going to be working with providers such as Ohio State, is to provide all of the tools on this website for providers, for the public, for businesses, for nursing homes, for everybody and families, so that they can identify whether they are a falls risk and to do something about it.
Don't the laws, the ADA laws, disability laws, don't they already have certain requirements imposed on businesses and restaurants and places like that to make themselves safer?
They absolutely have guidance. Thank you for bringing that up. And to make the world safer and to make their business safer. But this really goes beyond that. And what we're talking about at this point is common sense. Sometimes when a state takes something on, it doesn't have to be a huge investment of resources, and it can be something very simple. And what we're trying to do here is the simple, to bring everybody together to understand what those basic risks are. So an example might be in a store, shiny floors reflect on glasses like the ones you and I are mm-hmm. wearing. And as we get older, it is harder to recover from that glare. So something as simple as eliminating the shiny floor will make your business less of a falls risk. The bright lights that we're looking at right now and in many stores, that again creates glare. Having lights that are not overhead but are at the side. So this is very simple things. This is not anybody who is violating anything in the law. Mm-hmm. What it is making the environment more conducive to.
And, you know, we talk about it's just a third of Ohioans right now, but that number is going to grow incredibly in the next 20 years, the number of older Ohioans.
Oh, absolutely. And there are so many people that we feel are out there that could be at a risk for fall that don't even realize it. For example, if they get bifocals, that's a whole change of your vision along with your walking, going up and down stairs and that. So you want to be able to give them the education for prevention of that.
I wanted to go back to something that we hear about a lot is Aunt So-and-so fell. She broke her hip. The next thing you know, 3.5 weeks later, she has pneumonia. And then they die from a broken hip. Renee, can you take us through that and explain why that happens and what we know about that?
Well, for people that are 65 and older, there are the statistics out there that when they fall and break their hip, if they're not getting the proper mobility, they are at risk of, you probably know the stats better than me, that 25% of them can die within a year after that injury.
Because
they are not as mobile. It sets them up at higher health risk. And just the fears of not getting out and being active, they lose that strength, they lose their balance, and they lose their mobility, and then they just start to decline from there.
The morbidity and mortality following a fall, as Renee indicated, is unbelievable, and your statistics are absolutely right, Anne. But one of the things that the latest research has shown us is that the better shape you are in before you fall, the better chance you have of doing well after the fall. So one of the things that is so important, and you hear Governor Kasich talk about it all the time, is let's all get out and exercise. Let's make sure that we are living our lives to be the most vital person we can so that when something does happen to us or if something happens to us, we are able to recover as quickly as possible.
Yeah, when you get old, being slow, as you said, that's not natural. That's not part of being old, getting slower. It's just something that we've adapted stylistically as a society for some reason.
It's interesting that you say that, Anne, because the idea that when we age, we will decline is an outdated idea. That we call that the declinist view of aging, and it is out of date. We don't call older adults senior citizens. We call them elders. And as you age, you can become more vital. You have a lot to contribute, and you continue to grow and thrive. And that is the message that Governor Kasich and all of us are getting out, that throughout our lifespan, we've got so much to give. We are not declining. We are gaining wisdom.
Renee, is there a typical or common profile for people who fall? Are they old? Well, you know, age has something to do with it because of all these other things, not age per se, but other things that occur as you get older. So once you tumble, is it likely to happen again? Who are you looking for? Who's on your radar?
We are looking at anyone that may have had a stroke in the past, anyone that feels that they are unsafe within their home, or some people could have a decline in vision and aren't safe. And also you have that cognitive aspect. Mm-hmm. As we get older, if we're not exercising our brains the way we should be by staying active and staying in tune, then you can get some cognitive decline, and people may not pay attention to what they're doing as much. They could have hazards in their home. So we're looking at anyone that could, it doesn't matter what your age is, or if you've had a previous stroke, say a brain injury, an illness, that you're just not to that level, that physical activity level that you were at before, you may be at a risk.
And what we're going to do, Anne, at the state level and working with partners such as Ohio State, is to ensure that every clinician understands exactly what their responsibility is and what they can do to prevent falls. And our goal is to ensure that falls prevention and falls risk assessment is part of every clinician's evaluation of his or her patient.
Joe in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
I have experience working with older patients. I'm thinking of this one in particular. She was in the hospital as a result of falling. It was her second or third fall, and she had been a patient in assisted living facility or nursing home. And I remember talking to her daughter, and she repeatedly fell out of the chairs that they placed her in during the day. And I'm like, and I remember being in a nursing home as a nurse's aide years and years ago, and we would put a posy vest on the patient, and so he wouldn't fall out of the chair. And they're not allowed to do that. And she's like, well, they're not allowed to restrain the patients anymore. And I thought, how ironic that now this woman is in this danger and has had repeated falls, because in the nursing home where she's supposed to be taken care of, whatever their restrictions are, I don't know what, has allowed her to fall repeatedly.
All right, Joe, thanks for that call. Thank you very much. Bonnie Berman is the Ohio Department of Aging, and its program is, are they shooting for nursing homes too?
Absolutely. We have a six-pronged program, and one of our initiatives focuses specifically on nursing homes. And it's a little different approach, but it's complementary in that part of the reason folks do fall in nursing homes is the lighting is not always what it should be. I mean, how many of us have gone into nursing homes and say, oh, it's a little dark in there.
Right. Right.
And so we're going to be working with all of our nursing homes in the state to ensure that we are actually having people in lit situations so that falls don't occur.
Bonnie Berman, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Bonnie Berman, she's the director of the Ohio Department of Aging, and Renee Owens, physical therapist at the Wexner Medical Center. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.